You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is a combined issue, which includes December of 2022 and January of 2023, and this is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Sergeant's Orders by Nate Freeman, with photos by Raphael Pavarotti, styled by Gary David Moore. On the first Thursday of October, a few days before the start of the Frieze Art Fair in London, Gagosian opened its first show with Tyler Mitchell at its Mayfair space on Davis Street. Mitchell, 27, first came to widespread acclaim for his editorial work for Vogue and Vanity Fair, and the opening was scheduled for September in the heart of London Fashion Week. But Queen Elizabeth's death had caused the gallery to delay. The show was already a risk. An artist's first show at the gallery, a photography show in an art market that is crazy for painting, etc. Now it had to compete with the madness of an international art fair. I ran into Mitchell walking through Mayfair on the way to the show, and as we approached, I saw a series of diptych photos visible through the window. Unlike most of Gagosian's other galleries, this one has floor-to-ceiling windows to display the bulk of the show to the public, with the lights kept on until midnight. The works marked a major breakthrough for Mitchell. They draw on his history of celebrity photography, but turn his lens to young men and women to present a kind of utopian vision of American blackness. There's an office through an unmarked false wall at the back of the gallery, and I opened it to see Sargent sitting at the desk. He wore a brown Burberry suit, it's British, honey, and a shirt by Grace Wales Bonner, the London-based designer and artist who showed in social works, too, in London. Despite having been at his friend Madonna's Marylebone mansion until 5 in the morning, oh my God, she has Frida Kahlo and Picasso, and what's that guy we represent who does the women with the big boobs? Oh, John Curran. He did not seem the least bit tired. The people are rolling through, he said, fixing his hat on his head 2 minutes after the opening began. In came Amy Sherald, the artist who painted Michelle Obama's portrait, and now has new work selling for as much as $3.6 million. There was Lynette Yadam-Bokay, whose paintings have sold for more than $1.95 million at auction, chatting with fellow British artist Anthea Hamilton. From Los Angeles came rising star Lauren Halsey, and also present was Alvaro Barrington, the painter who shows with London's Sadie Coles HQ and the Viennese-born London dealer Thaddeus Ropak. Bonner came by, as did fellow fashion designer Ireland Simone Rojas, as did Edward Enninful, the editor of British Vogue. Anna Wintour had a private tour from Mitchell the day before. Christian Amanpour was there, but so were hundreds of young people of color, along with bankers and Savile Row fits, there to get a peek at the commotion on their way home from the pubs. At 7:40, a sales assistant burst out of the gallery and into the street and went up to Sargent's assistant with word the show had sold out. Moments later, Sargent emerged from the back office, where he had been closing deals he had spent months setting up. It's been all sold, even the editions. And you know how effing hard it is to sell photo, he said, and I sold 2/3 of it myself. So if there was any question about whether I can sell. With the gallery still crowded, Sargent, Mitchell, and more VIPs made their way to a private room at Maison Estelle, a Mayfair private club, chosen, perhaps, because it has a no-pictures policy that requires guests to put stickers over their phone's lenses. Obrist came by, as did Nathan Clements Gillespie, the director of Frieze Masters, who commissioned several works from Mitchell for the fair. Mitchell's Hollywood agent from UTA was there, as was his gallery rep at Jack Shaneman, the Chelsea space that gave him his first gallery show the year before. After hours of champagne and Negronis sent around on trays, the waiters wheeled out a gigantic cake for Mitchell with the name of his show written in cursive on top. Sargent ripped the sticker off his phone to take photos. "We got here with the Queen and everything. We got here," he said to me, cocktail in hand, as slices of the cake were passed around. "They did everything they could do to stop me, and we got here." Just then, a sales assistant came to grab him, flashing phone to be answered in hand. Sargent excused himself. "Hold on," he said. "I got to take care of some business." In the photos, social capital. Sargent with Micheline Thomas in 2018. At the Young, Gifted, and Black exhibition with Bernard Lumpkin and Matt Wyckoff. At a 2019 reception for the New Black Vanguard at Aperture. At the New Black Vanguard exhibition at Les Rencontres d'Art in 2021. At the Metropolitan Museum of Art's Acquisitions Gala in 2021 with Lorna Simpson and Jeremy O. Harris. At a Sean Kelly gallery party with Awal Erisku, Jaja Fay, Lauren Kelly, Susanna Herbert, and Ali Bernia in 2014. At the release of the New Black Vanguard in 2019, with Tyler Mitchell, Harris, and interview editor Mel Ottenberg in 2021. At the Obama Portraits opening reception at the Brooklyn Museum with Kehinde Wiley in 2021, with Miles Greenberg at a 2020 Gucci runway show. across the universe, Chloe creative director Gabriella Hurst is drawing fashion inspiration from clean energy, and the results are electrifying, by Keziah Weir, with photographs by Joachim Eskildsen. Opening photo, in the glow, Gabriella Hurst visits the Tecamac building at the ITER campus in the south of France. The Tecamac-esque runway at the Chloe Spring Summer 2023 show. I think by now you know the difference between magnetic fusion and inertial fusion, Gabriella Hurst says to me as she toggles through images of industrial blueprints on her phone. It's a question one might expect to hear in a course on plasma physics, or at least the physics pop quiz of this word person's nightmares. But no, we're in Hurst's sunny New York design studio, settling in to discuss the spring-summer collection from Chloe, where she has held the role of creative director since 2020. Outside the glass door of her office, her team darts between mood boards and clothing racks and models draped in slinky black garments. Inside, wearing a navy silk shirt and a tweed baseball cap under which she has tucked her blonde hair, Hurst is still and focused. She is making fusion fashion, a concept that has occupied her design mind for the last year. Fusion is the main source of energy in the universe, Hurst says, referring to the process of stellar nucleosynthesis, by which protons fuse at the core of all stars, emitting heat and light. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for fusion, because we are made out of dead stars. One could say the same of her spring-summer collection, which was inspired by site visits to labs in the Pacific Northwest, New England, and the south of France, where hundreds of scientists and engineers are working to develop technology that will produce a net energy gain through fusion, an as yet unattained goal. Hurst and others refer to them as star builders. Nuclear fusion, like fission, doesn't produce long-term waste, lacks the potential for meltdown, and has the capacity to produce a lifetime's worth of energy from the hydrogen atoms in a single glass of water, something of a climate crisis silver bullet. The Chloe models were clad in appropriately physics-inflected designs. Hurst sent a board of 8 fuchsia fabric swatches to one company, so that their team could color match the pinky purple shade of a fusion reaction. Hydrogen isotopes, deuterium and tritium, appear as abstract patterns across the clothes. They walked a runway designed to resemble a tokamak, the donut-shaped device that produces energy through the magnetic fusion of atoms. The Mexico-based light artist Paolo Montilcopa created enormous incandescent rings representing magnets, which floated above the stage. Other designers have attempted to render poetic the ravages of climate change. This spring, Demna Vesalia sent his models into a human-made blizzard. Following the designation of the monarch butterfly as an endangered species this summer, Colina Strada's September show took place in a preserve amid fields of milkweed. And fashion has publicly struggled with the problems the industry itself creates. A 2020 report by the nonprofit environmental agency Stand.Earth found that the global fashion industry is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than both aviation and the shipping sector. Despite customer-facing public commitments by brands and CEOs, LVMH, Kering, Hermes, the largest pieces of the fashion supply chain remain dependent on coal for both electricity generation and heat used in apparel manufacturing. Bleaching, dyeing, weaving, finishing garments, transportation. And so the biggest question of all, Hurst believes, is one that faces not just fashion, but all industries in a global system that derives 80% of its power from fossil fuels. Where are we getting our energy? It is the twofold way in which Hurst attempts to grapple with this question that sets her apart, in aesthetics and through action. In the photos, Net Energy, a view inside ITER. Chloe models wear looks inspired by the colors and silhouettes of Fusion Laboratories. The brand's lower impact Nama sneaker comprises 40% of its weight from recycled materials. Her collections broadcast the themes, while Hurst simultaneously enforces transparency and innovation on production levels. Her mission is woven into the very fibers of her clothes. In her early 20s, Hurst developed a trick to alleviate her anxiety. I created this thing called my wish list. Whenever I feel anxiety, I write the opposite of what I feel. The opposite of Hurst's largest anxiety, climate disaster, she realized last year, is climate success. I started repeating it to myself like a mantra, she says. Climate success, climate success, climate success, climate success. Hurst, who was born in Uruguay in 1976 and raised on her father's 17,000-acre Paysandú cattle ranch, Santa Isabel, grew up with an entrenched understanding of conservation and ethical consumption. After her father's death in 2011, Hurst, the eldest of four, inherited her childhood home and its surrounding ranchland. It wasn't until her husband, John Augustine Chilton Hurst, called Austin, pointed out her unique background that she realized what she took for granted about her upbringing might play into her fashion career. He was the first person to say to me, "You need to talk about how you grew up," Hurst says. "You need to use the wool of your farm in your clothing." For this year's Gabriella Hurst Spring Runway Show, she produced a broadsheet with images of a recent family visit. Hurst and one of her daughters riding in the back of a truck, a herd of cattle in the sunlight. In her office, the designer taps her finger on a photograph of her mother, a Buddhist and fourth-generation rancher, amid a tangle of trees. "This is where I was conceived," she says, "in her forest." In a family of ranchers, Hurst describes herself as the odd one out. As a child, she loved to draw. Once, after watching the transformation scene in Disney's Cinderella, she took a pair of scissors to her grandmother's silk dress. While attending the British schools, a high school in Montevideo, Hurst won a scholarship to spend a year in Australia, which kicked off a decade of travel. She returned home to study communications at the Universidad ORT Uruguay, left again to model in Paris and Milan, and joined the neighborhood playhouse Acting Conservatory in Manhattan. Acting didn't stick, but New York did. In 2003, following a stint as a sales director in a showroom, Hurst launched a Brooklyn-based contemporary line called Candela. In Spanish, the word means cheeky. In physics, it's a measure of luminous intensity, with two partners and an investment of $700 each. The brand's earliest offering was a T-shirt printed with a silk-screened image of a winged woman on horseback. The photograph of Hurst's mother that inspired it is still propped in her office. A decade later, the brand was profitable, and Hurst was a member of the Council of Fashion Designers of America. That year, she married Austin, a grandson of publishing scion William Randolph Hurst, whom she met at a party in Buenos Aires in 2004. "Initially, I didn't like him," Hurst once told Vogue, "but he became one of Candela's early investors, and now she describes him as one of my muses. He's one of these people that sees 10 years ahead of the game," she says. "He has this kind of vision." The pair founded Hurst eponymous brand in 2015 and now split their time between their West Village townhouse, marble, leather, and heritage bibelot from Hurst Castle, and a place outside Garrison, New York, in the Hudson Valley. Reclaimed wood, Nakashima chairs. They have a 7-year-old son, plus Hurst's 14-year-old twin daughters from her previous marriage and Austin's 2 children from his. The Gabriella Hurst debut collection, which Barney's stocked right next to Chloe, featured a calf-length leather skirt, a sheer navy dress with immaculate knife pleats, and delicate V-neck sweaters. In 2017, after Donald Trump took office, Hurst designed a merino wool sweater with a graphic of a stylized ram's head that could also be read as ovaries and a uterus. She sold each of the 100 pieces for $699, $500 of which went to Planned Parenthood. When the Supreme Court handed down the Dobbs decision this year, she reissued the sweater under the same terms. A trip with a humanitarian aid organization, Save the Children, to Turkana, Kenya, later that year, prompted her laser focus on sustainability. The country was in the middle of a drought that has only intensified, she says, and she met mothers who had to make the hard choice of what child to save, to take to a clinic where they have to walk 4 kilometers. There was no water. All the livestock is dead. Developing nations, she says, are paying the price for how we live in the developed world. Some say that there's no such thing as ethical consumption under capitalism. Hurst is a pragmatist. I'm a luxury designer, she says. A luxury designer means that you need to know where everything comes from and how everything is made, from soup to nuts. In 2019, she's widely credited with the fashion industry's first carbon-neutral runway show, working with the production company Bureau Batak to assess and reduce the show's carbon footprint, and then with the climate consultancy EcoAct to provide a carbon offset by donating to the Hifadi Livelihoods Project, which provides efficient cook stoves to communities in Kenya's Embu and Tharaka Nithi counties. When I ask Hurst, who spends significant time on airplanes between New York, Paris, and Uruguay, and also on inspiration-gathering trips with her team, including for the Fusion Collection, whether all that jet fuel causes her grief, she tells me that she has moved up from offsetting and now works with Climate Works to sequester her carbon load. All of these endeavors cost money. But what's the real cost? Hurst asked. We are pushing forward this bill that no one's paying. Somebody has to say we are responsible. We have to find a way because of our children, the next generation. The world is theirs. It's not ours anymore. And if you don't take the role of our guardianship seriously, meaning at all cost, she trails off. For all her engagement with hard science, Hurst identifies as a spiritual person. Her family didn't want to baptize her, but I asked to be baptized. I believe in Jesus in the way I believe in Buddha, in the way I believe in all deities. I think spirituality is part of the human condition, she says. I know a lot of things exist that I don't see. It's possible Hurst's role at Chloe, a label launched in Paris in 1952 by Gabriel Ayon, a Jewish communist sympathizer who hired Karl Lagerfeld to succeed her, was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Hurst's first luxury purchase, she says, was a Chloe Edith bag. Later, she had a dream that she was helming the brand. In 2020, she submitted a 92-page brief on her proposed direction for the brand. The main driver, she says, besides my love for Chloe, was to see if the 7 years that we have had at Gabriella Hurst as research and development on environmental practices could be upscaled to a brand that was 70 years old. And how fast can that deployment be? Faster than expected, it turned out. Last fall, under the direction of Hurst and CEO Riccardo Bellini, Chloe became the first luxury fashion house B Corp, a designation given to corporations that meet criteria pertaining to transparency and high standards of social and environmental performance. Chloe currently scores an 85.2. 80 is the bar for certification, and the median score for typical businesses is 50.9. October 2021 was precisely when fusion seized Hearst, as she read an article in the Financial Times on its feasibility, once a far distant hope that in recent years has begun to seem tantalizingly close. And then I started to research, she says. She read about the most expansive nuclear fusion project on Earth, a 35-nation and thus far nearly three-decades-long collaboration called the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, or ITER, Latin for the way, which is under construction some 650 kilometers south of Paris in Saint-Paul-le-Durance. Upon completion, it will be the world's largest tokamak. The project began with a handshake between Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, and will, per its mission statement, prove the feasibility of fusion as a large-scale and carbon-free source of energy. She learned about the private companies throughout the world on their own races toward fusion. She became so entrenched that on occasion, when speaking about the star builders, she refers to them as we. She's got great neuroplasticity, says ITER Communications Director Laban Koblenz of Hearst. I would swear that in 7 years of bringing every kind of visitor here, technically smart people, people with engineering degrees, senators and parliamentarians, and even heads of state, I would say when Gabby showed up on the 10th of May of this year, she was the most well-educated layperson on fusion science I had ever seen. Hearst visited Commonwealth Fusion Systems, a private Massachusetts-based company founded in collaboration with MIT that aims to produce net energy plasma by 2025, and Washington-based Helion, which has a target for commercial systems on the grid by the end of this decade. For most of its history, in discussions of fusion, people often use the analogy of building a cathedral, says Alex Creeley, the CFS plasma physicist who weighed in on the creation of Chloe's tokamak-esque runway. Building a cathedral took 100 years. You might never achieve it in your lifetime, but you're contributing to something grand. For those working in the field today, that's no longer the case. While the boom in fusion will feel sudden to some, just days before the Chloe show this fall, the Department of Energy announced a $50 million earmark to be dispersed among for-profit fusion companies teaming up with universities and national labs. It's the result of decades of research and innovation. I like taking the pandemic case as a comparison, says Hearst. We had a vaccine within a year, when people were predicting 4 years, and billions of dollars went into this vaccine because the alternative 4 years of lockdown on the economy would not have been acceptable. We are in the case here that I would argue is worse. The more I talk to people, Hearst says, the more I realized there's a communication bridge. People just don't know about this. Per Koblenz, Gabby has a unique sense of how the artistic temperament and the scientific temperament can help to advance each other's narratives. Hearst is executing her climate narrative over 4 collections. For fall 22, she focused on the concept of rewilding and, with input from the British conservationist Isabella Tree, filled her runway with a physical manifestation of her anxiety reduction list. Recycled cashmere sweaters and painted leather bags, a waste product of the meat industry, she says, that portrayed images of disaster on one side, a scorched mountain landscape, melting icebergs, and success on the other, a field of poppies below a green peak, a pair of polar bears. All humans, we're all connected. All species, we're all connected. We all live in this environment. The idea of a division is a false concept, Hearst says. Next, her primarily monochromatic resort collection served as the introductory course in her stealth mission to deliver fusion literacy to the masses. Laser-cut star motifs, spangled black leather jackets, embroiderie anglaise frocks, and spring, summer, bursting with color and symbolism as her master class. What I can do is to use whatever platform I have to communicate about this energy. The final chapter in Hearst's ongoing creative endeavor, she tells me, is really understanding our brain. How do we make better informed decisions? We need to change a bit of our consciousness in order to evolve, because there's something about our programming that's just not working right now. I understand that I can close my eyes and go to watch Netflix and drink a matcha latte, but that is a sort of apathy, Hearst says. If you were not in a position of survival, you need to help others, and you need to be of service. With her vast network of resources, I chose to have a family and my husband. I chose to have these two jobs. I had a very dangerous pregnancy with my daughters. My son was 7 rounds of IVF. She delivers this in the same neutral, propulsive tone she employed when describing how she persuaded a 70-year-old Parisian fashion house to translate a theoretical scientific endeavor into a tangible collection of luxury women's wear. Everything I've done in my life that is worth it has taken a lot of work. The Knight's Tale by Adam Ciralsky. At lavish gatherings from Monaco to the Middle East, Anthony Ratosa built a lucrative business, convening the titans who control the family offices of the uber-wealthy. But the self-styled Knight of the Realm and purported Nobel Prize nominee turned out to be a Wall Street washout, a deadbeat dad, and a dangerous con man. Illustrations by Mark Smith. Opening illustration depicts a poolside party with guest attired in business casual. It was a warm June evening in Monaco. Outside, yachts were plying the azure sea. Inside, flashbulbs were popping. Anthony Ratosa was in his element. Charming and cherubic, Ratosa was glad-handing in front of a step-and-repeat backdrop at the Fairmont Monte Carlo. His permatan, sun-kissed hair, and tailored suit suggested a man of refined wealth and taste. An outsider might easily have mistaken the scene for a movie premiere nearby Cannes, but that would have undersold the pomp and pomposity of the moment. Sir Anthony, as he likes to be called, was holding court, welcoming guest to his 19th Ratosa Family Office Investment Summit, a confab of royals, sheikhs, and ultra-high net worth individuals that he bills as the most highly acclaimed gathering of global wealth of all time. By his count, people representing over $4.5 trillion in investor wealth have shown up at his conferences in Dubai, Miami, Monaco, and Riyadh, events where startups and entrepreneurs come to pitch the rich and have walked away, in Ratosa's estimate, with more than $2.8 billion in new funding. The gathering this past summer was held under the high patronage of His Serene Highness Prince Albert II of Monaco. Though the prince was not on hand, his endorsement loomed large. His name topped the invitations. His foundation's logo was splashed across a banner along the red carpet. Ratosa's regal affiliations, however, extend beyond this microstate on the Côte d'Azur. Members of some of the most powerful families in the Gulf, Al Khalifa, Bahrain, Al Maktoum, UAE, Al Nahyan, UAE, Al Saud, Saudi Arabia, and Al Thani, Qatar, have had their names and pictures emblazoned on promotional materials for Ratosa's soirees. Other dynasties have graced the publicity announcements. Von Bismarck, Bonaparte, Kennedy, Rockefeller, along with people purportedly affiliated with such heavyweight brands as Amazon, Audible, Facebook, Meta, and Rothschild & Company. One of the Monaco Affair's platinum sponsors was the crypto newcomer Unicoin, represented on the agenda by Rosie Rios, 43rd U.S. Treasurer, and Joe Biden's choice to lead America's 250th Anniversary Commission, who had given a keynote at the previous Ratosa meeting in Riyadh. In short, Sir Anthony's summits are so chock-a-block with luminaries that many associated with the event may have failed to ask one fundamental question. Who the hell is Anthony Ratosa? After a year-long investigation, including interviews with sources from a dozen countries, Vanity Fair uncovered the truth. It turns out he is a Wall Street washout, a world-class con man, and an inveterate fabulist with a bogus CV and persona. A 53-year-old Australian who fancifully purports to be an heir to a 600-year-old European olive oil fortune. What's more, he entices people to attend his summits under often dubious pretenses, not infrequently requesting a cut of the action from presenters. And finally, this self-proclaimed maestro of family wealth is actually a thrice-married deadbeat dad who has been repeatedly jailed in Europe and is wanted in the U.S. after threatening to harm his own wife and family. A man about whom Lieutenant Greg Sancho of the Pelham Manor, New York Police Department told Vanity Fair We have an active warrant for Anthony Ritos's arrest for criminal contempt in the first degree. That's a felony. I had heard complaints about Ritos's summits from a circle of entrepreneurs who felt hoodwinked. So to get a better handle on the guy, I first stopped in London in June to attend the Family Office Forum, held a week before Sir Anthony's. Put on by Pristell and Partner, it is one of the best-regarded gatherings of its kind, and took place at the Posh Corinthia Hotel, a stone's throw from 10 Downing Street. In the often alien patois of finance, family offices are easy to understand. They are privately held companies the super-rich use to manage their fortunes. Genuine family offices, in the eyes of finance professionals, are those with at least $100 million in investable assets. Such entities, often overseen by professionals working with a cadre of relatives, tend to have fewer institutional controls and a high risk tolerance, allowing them to funnel a portion of their wealth into ventures with less predictable returns. As a result, family offices can be prime targets for financial predators. The London conference, organized by Tobias Pristell, a German entrepreneur, and the banking veteran Katja Mülheim, was attended by an array of industrialists, aristocrats, ultra-high net worth individuals, and family offices from around the world. Pristell sat down with me and took me back to 2014. At that year's event, held in Zurich, Ritos's Center representative, what played in Anthony's favor when we looked to see if he qualified as family office, said Pristell, was that there was almost no negative information about him online. Around that time, in bios submitted to similar conferences in Miami, Ritosa presented himself as having an MBA with distinction in finance from Harvard University. His personal narrative would later appear on his website, on LinkedIn, and in publications targeting the mega-rich. He boasted of a distinguished Wall Street career and more than 30 years of international financial markets and investment experience. Ritosa also claimed to be an heir to an olive oil fortune dating back to the 15th century. The story is colorful. The gnarled roots of the Ritosa olive groves have persevered through war and natural disaster, and under the rule of warrior princes, wealthy merchant kings, and modern despots. The company's fields, he noted, have long been in Istria, a peninsula that was once part of Italy, but now largely straddles Croatia and Slovenia. He talked about his olive oil fortune all the time, explained Jason Kavanaugh, an Australian who runs his own Monaco-based family office. He presents very well. I ran across Anthony at conferences in Monaco, London, and Geneva around 2014 to 2015. He introduced himself as a fellow Australian running a family office looking to get involved in the family office community. He absolutely was not a sir then. Matthias Knab was strolling the beach in Miami in early 2016 when he ran into his old acquaintance Anthony Ritosa. He had not seen him in years. Cerebral and solemn, Knab runs the alternative investment media firm Opalesque and serves as a senior advisor to Castle Hall, an international due diligence company. We chatted, Knab recalled, over tea at a mosaicked garden in London's Westminster, and he said he'd been doing stuff with his family office, which was weird because he was a typical salesman, selling structured notes to hedge funds. When I knew him, I didn't think of Anthony as a high net worth individual. At first, Ritosa attended family office-focused conferences, but in 2016, he co-hosted his own, a joint venture between a Kuwaiti conglomerate and his newly minted Ritosa family office, representing his family businesses dating back 600 years to the Venetian Empire. Together, they put on two summits in Dubai, but according to Knab, who helped advertise the latter, Ritosa was eager to go solo. Anthony rang me in March 2017 and said he wanted to do a family office conference in Monaco in June, recalled Kavanaugh. I thought he meant 2018, but he wanted it 3 months later. I told him it couldn't be done, but Anthony went ahead and put my name on the program as chairman of the conference. Kavanaugh, peeved but not dissuaded, was sufficiently well-placed in Monaco to attract the principality's high and mighty. Even though I never agreed to it, it was too late to pull out, or I would have looked like a clown. Nub moderated panels, and Opalesque served as a media partner, helping telegraph the event's importance to the financial world. That first summit in Monaco was very low profile, Giuseppe Ambrosio remembered, as we had coffee at the Hotel Hermitage Monte Carlo, an architectural gym with a glass cupola designed by Gustave Eiffel. Back then, Ambrosio was an audit partner for Deloitte and president of the Monaco Single and Multifamily Office International Association. As his relationship with Ritosa blossomed, he began opening some very important doors. I vouched for him with the prince and the palace, Ambrosio said regretfully. And in 2018, following the usual vetting, Ambrosio recalled, Ritosa's patronage request was granted. Yet, as Ritosa's ambitions and audacity grew, his conferences changed their tenor and his origin story, as revealed here for the first time, began to disintegrate. Sir Anthony's only U.S. summit took place in Miami in late 2017 at the St. Regis Bile Harbor Resort. It was a two-day thing, said Kavanaugh, who chaired the affair. Some good families, some good topics, but a little crypto started creeping in. Nob was there as well and recalled, initially these conferences were really sweet. Planning, however, was hampered when Ritosa went off the grid 2 months before the kickoff, a time when Nob was scheduled to visit him in Slovenia, where Ritosa sometimes stays when he is not at his penthouse in Dubai's luxurious Bulgari residences. As the trip grew near, Nob recounted, the Australian was simply unreachable. This was actually the first red flag. Upon reemerging, Ritosa explained his absence via WhatsApp. I just got back from Sydney this evening. It's been a rough 2 weeks with my mum. She had a stroke and is now stable, thankfully. I'm back and can now focus 100% on Miami. The summit proceeded. But by the following March, at the next conclave in Dubai, the atmosphere had changed. It was nothing like what Ritosa was advertising, Nob maintained. It became a massive circus with lots of sellers, hawking, offerings, and crypto. It became a huge machine for Ritosa. Nob had seen enough. In June, he announced that he and Kavanaugh were terminating their relationship with Ritosa's summits, citing differences over the direction of these conferences and other reasons. Kavanaugh also pulled out of the fast-approaching 2018 gathering in Monaco, which he says he was slated to chair, prompting a key Monaco minister to bail. The 1-2 punch riled Ritosa, who pleaded with his fellow Aussie over WhatsApp, "Can you please stop arranging for other people to resign? That's not appropriate, mate." Meanwhile, Ritosa's Slovenian lawyer sent a letter to Nob, ordering him to remove his post and threatening litigation. Nob did not budge. Ritosa backed off. Still, the summit, with Prince Albert as patron, went on anyway. Little by little I learned, Ambrosio confided, the biggest mistake I made was to take him to the palace and help get him the patronage so that the conference looks like it's blessed by Prince Albert. Ambrosio, like Kavanaugh, Nob, and others, asserted he has cut all ties with Ritosa. Then when he started calling himself Sir, I couldn't stand it. Indeed, Ritosa's image and his enterprise were about to get even stranger. It was at the 2019 Monaco summit that Ritosa received his own lofty title when the Knights Society of Elvinia inducted him into their ranks. thereby catapulting a man born Anthony Ronnie Ritosa to Sir Anthony. The new knight would later receive the Grand Cross from the Royal Order of Banu Asaf. Behind these accolades stood two enigmatic men, both of whom have served as key figures in Ritosa's orbit. The first was His Excellency Professor Sir Manuel Freire Garibal y Núñez, who describes himself as a Spanish lawyer, diplomat, and journalist, and he misspells journalist, and founder at Chairman of Al Khalifa Business School, AKBS. Though grammar and spelling are not his strong suits, the young Spaniard, in his online profile, claims to hold an MBA and to have completed more than 300 courses and specializations in different areas from Ivy League and elite business schools. He states that he has served as a contributor of higher education to UC Berkeley, USC, and Yale, and as a professor, collaborator, and advisor to many universities across the globe, including the Harvard Medical School, all at age 27. But there's more. Freire Garibal says he founded the Knight Society of Elvinia in 2016 as a hobby, and now serves as its Grand Chancellor. Over the years, he purports to have racked up high civil honors from the states of Arkansas and Kentucky and the local governments of Machu Picchu, Medley, and North Miami Beach. What's more, Sir Manuel's website, a must-read, notes that the Russian Federation presented him with the Grand Cross of Ruby Arslanga, an honor, he claims, that has previously gone to Cuba's Fidel Castro, as well as second- and third-class personalities of art and culture, such as Alec Baldwin. And there's a misspelling there with the first name. Also central to Sir Anthony's knight's tale is His Highness Mahmud Salah al-Din Asaf, a hereditary royal prince of the 7th century Asaf dynasty of the Mamluk Sultanate of the Persian Khazarwan of Mount Lebanon. Judging from the glamour shot that accompanies his online resumes, the man is a passionate falconer. At 36, he claims to have received some extraordinary honors, including the Presidential Lifetime Achievement Award and the highest title of honor bestowed by the governor of Kentucky. Still, these seemed like small ball compared with what he cites as his 2015 appointment as ambassador at large of the UN Registered Brotherhood of Dragons. More on His Excellency and His Highness shortly. Neither would talk for this story. Moreover, Ritosa, after replying to an initial email, did not respond to numerous requests to participate, nor did he agree to answer questions submitted by Vanity Fair. Ritosa's 13th summit was in full swing at Dubai's Waldorf Astoria Palm Jumeirah on December 8, 2020, when 3,500 miles away in Germany, Matthias Knob received an unexpected message. It included a link to a website called fakefamilyoffice.com that began, "I need to warn you about a nefarious operator, Anthony Ritosa, who is a pretender in the world of family offices and should not be trusted with your time and essentially your money." What followed was a takedown that questioned and mocked Sir Anthony's title, educational credentials, career milestones, and claims about an olive oil fortune and a family office. Denny Charid, a one-time financial journalist who now runs his own private wealth meetings, also passed info from the link around. Word filtered back to Ritosa, and Charid, like Knob, soon received a cease and desist letter from Ritosa's Slovenian attorney. Charid was amused by the suggestion that he had defamed Ritosa merely by sharing the contents of a public domain URL. "This is so ridiculous. I will not even bring it to my lawyer's attention," he wrote back, adding, "I believe most of the website's claims." In time, Ritosa's lawyers would send a similarly toothless warning to Graham David Bell, a Dubai-based corporate finance advisor whose clients include some very real and very wealthy sheikhs. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.